Welcome back to Canucks Talk here on Sportsnet 650. Jamie Dodd, Thomas Drance, we're live from the Kintec studio. 650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. Dunbar Lumber with three stores to serve you in Ladner on Bridge Street, or Dunbar Lumber Express at Ladner Center, or Arbutus in Vancouver, online at dunbarlumber.com. The hotline brought to you by Dispatch Plumbing, Heating, and Air Conditioning. The first call, the only call, and we now go to the Dispatch Plumbing, Heating, and Air Conditioning hotline, where we are joined by our next guest from Sportsnet Hockey Night in Canada. He is Kyle Bukauskas. Kyle, thank you for doing this. How are you?
Hey, good, gentlemen. How are you guys doing? Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, no, it's our pleasure. We're doing very well. Interesting one between the Canucks and the Avs last night. Colorado coming back from 3-0 down to win that one in overtime. Lots of different talking points here. The refs, some other things going on. What did you think of the game between the two teams last night?
I will say, like, over the years, getting a chance to work with Craig Simpson, and especially, you know, around playoff time or the lead up to it, he is always so fixated, like, on just those little moments in a game that can change an outcome and can change the course of a lot of things. And I just thought, like, last night you're in a good spot, up 3-0, and then to give the one up there, like, at the final few seconds there of the second period, and give Colorado some life, that was like a big moment. And then, of course, like, the puck over glass in the dying seconds of the third set them up to end the game in overtime. Like, it just, I thought it was a really good lesson for Vancouver that came out of the doors there guns a-blazing there last night, that man, like, just like little moments in a game that if you're not sharp and not able to execute when called upon, you know, especially playing a team of Colorado's caliber, and going to see more of that here as they gear up for the postseason, it can totally change a game. And then when you get to the playoffs, it can change a whole series around. So I imagine that was a pretty good lesson for the Canucks as they've been, you know, on a good little run here of late, but try to recoup themselves here going forward.
Yeah, one of the interesting things about the Canucks this year, of course, is, you know, they went from a lottery team for quite a few years in a row to all of a sudden looking like a contender. And I think sometimes that can be an advantage, right? You know, the whole they don't know what they don't know thing when it gets to the playoffs. But I think it's also fair to have questions about how will this group that, you know, there are veterans who've gone deep and won cups like Ian Cole, but the kind of core players haven't really gone through a traditional playoff run together. And I think it's fair to have questions about how they'll respond in the hothouse of the playoffs. Do you think, you know, that kind of composure issue could be a major question for this Canucks team in the playoffs?
Yeah, I guess because it's always kind of one of those, I guess, you know, chicken or the egg type discussions. Like, you've never really gone through it until you go through it, right? And so I thought, again, like, kind of, was that early in February where they were going through their skid, and, you know, Rick Tocchet had the line there about, like, it's only going to get hotter around just the results and the pressure and the tension. I just thought that was, you know, for so much success and how good things have been going in Vancouver for much of the season, which has been, you know, terrific to watch, and great for the market to be able to enjoy that again. And someone who grew up on Vancouver Island there through, like, the West Coast Express and then the Sedin and Luongo era, where playoffs were pretty much an automatic most seasons. It's been great to see that sort of those types of vibes come back here again this year. But you know, to your point, and you guys see much more of the Canucks over 82 games than I do living here out east. But it's not a bad thing to go through. And again, I firmly believe that, you know, you can make the case of an inexperienced team versus an experienced group come a seven game series. But you know, until you have gone through it, you can make all the reasons for why it might not work. But at some point, you know, you've got to be able to handle those moments the right way. And so, you know, a moment like last night or going through, you know, a skid like they did in February and being able to come out on the right side of it. And now, you know, losing your top goalie for a couple of weeks here and weathering that storm and trying to still get results in light of all that, you know, they're still in a good spot where as they continue to work through and find answers, and by all indications, they seem to have the right makeup in the room to deal with it all. You know, it just sets them up for and hopefully for their case, when adversity does hit and things get a little rocky in the playoffs, they've got some morals to kind of fall back on and realize, we're okay here, guys. We've had to deal through stuff already this year, and this will be nothing new. It's always such a fascinating thing to watch come the playoffs is, which teams handle the tougher moments the best.
Kyle, we've got four Canadian-bound teams, right? And obviously we know the hardcore fans of each team want none of them to succeed except their own. But there's a lot of casual hockey fans in this country that will watch the playoffs and just like root for the last Canadian team standing. And that'll set off a round of are they Canada's team think pieces and another skirmish yeah. on hockey Twitter. In terms of the four playoff-bound Canadian teams, how would you rank their prospects to be accepted without too much controversy as Canada's team should they make a deep run?
Oh, wow. Wow. Jeez Louise.
I know. This is a tough one to ask a media guy who works on the East Coast on Vancouver Radio, but I trust you to do it, man. You've got the perspective.
Yeah. I appreciate all the confidence you have in me here, Dranson. This is great. Because thinking back to 2011, it was definitely not bad for Vancouver out of the BC region. But I feel it's a completely different feel now in a lot of aspects. They've got a chance. Are Winnipeg just kind of that, the little engine that could? And is there enough that, maybe they'd have the best chance? I don't know, McDavid and Draisaitl, they've probably tormented enough fan bases, at least during the regular season for sure, that it's harder to gather steam for them. But so maybe Winnipeg 1, Vancouver 2, Edmonton 3, Toronto 4?
Yeah, Toronto 4 with a bullet.
You got 1 and 4 were easy there. 1 is Winnipeg, 4 is Toronto.
You think
sure.
Winnipeg, eh?
100%.
Do you think it's because the Jets?
Who hates the Jets? No one.
They just have a history of being unobjectionable.
People are happy that they got the team back. I know that's worn off a little bit, but there's no prime rival to get angry against. Nobody hates the Jets. That's my argument.
Right. So it's really a Vancouver Edmonton argument.
Yeah.
So it's the star power McDavid versus. Anyway, I think you nailed it. I think he got. I think Kyle got the list right. What do you think?
Yeah. Well done.
Wow.
You crushed it, man. A++.
Right. See you guys. Thanks for having me.
The old George Costanza.
Well, now how about this? Which Canadian team has the best chance of winning the Stanley Cup going into the playoffs?
Yeah. Oh, man. I know. It's like, and I honestly dislike doing the whole prediction team thing the most here. Especially because, I mean, who knows how ultimately, we've still got, just under 20 games for most teams here to go. So how will the standings look like today? Are they going to look like that come the first round? But if Vancouver has to play Vegas, that's your reward for winning the West here. And who knows, which guys are going to have coming back from game 1 of the playoffs. There's an element of cruelty that feels there. And then as much as we've liked how Winnipeg has done much of this season, to have to go through that central division, it's going to be a challenge, but I suppose you can make the case that you're going to have to beat good teams one way or another if you want to go the distance here. So I don't know. And then I'm kind of staying in the Pacific here, maybe Vancouver or Edmonton. And I promise I'm not thinking that only because I'm speaking on Vancouver radio. I know it's the Oilers have kind of, fizzled and run out of steam, the last couple of playoff rounds. But they've been in the mix. I like the way they've come on here. But let's say I don't care for the predictions, and I try not to get too wrapped up in it because it's how can you possibly know? There's so many factors to go into all of those types of calls. But maybe I'm kind of leading Edmonton right now. But we're just picking from the four Canadian teams who's got the best chance. That's kind of where my eyes keep coming back to.
We'll open it up beyond or south of the 49th parallel. Which team made deadline moves that really caught your eye?
I liked what Colorado did.
Yeah.
Just filling out their bottom six.
We liked what we saw yesterday. Whew.
Yeah, right. You got the freshest viewing of that. It seemed like the West did a lot more of the loading up than the East. Like kind of a flip of what happened last year. I know Carolina got shut out against the Rangers the other night, but I mean they've been a team that struggled to score come the postseason, and I think they did a solid attempt at addressing that and bringing in Gensel, and then we'll hope that you can have Evgeny Kuznetsov, you know, in the right climate and culture and situation there with what they've got going in Raleigh. I don't mind the moves that they made there either. And then even Florida has been, you know, great all year, just making a couple little adds there and throwing an Okpozo on the fourth line. And Tarasenko seems to be fitting in pretty good out of the gate here early on. I felt the same way about Boston last year with their trade deadline ads. Like they were headed for a record historic type season, and I loved who they even brought into the trade deadline, and we all remember how that turned out for them. So I'm trying to be cautious of that as I'm looking at where the Panthers are at. But between those three, like I thought they had good deadlines and good run ups to the deadline, and trying to make their teams better and address kind of what's been lacking maybe in years past.
Speaking of the Colorado Avalanche, Nikita Zadorov made some headlines here yesterday before the game, talking about his former teammate Nathan MacKinnon, saying he'd take him over anybody in the NHL, best player in the league, best player in the world, and he'd choose him over McDavid, over Matthews to build a team around. And I mean, man, Nathan MacKinnon leading the NHL in points, seems like he's got a very, very good chance to win the Hart Trophy this year. Are you ready to get on board with what Big Z is putting down there?
Yeah, it's a tough one, you know. Like again,
they're all pretty good.
Yeah, I mean, I continue to look at the guy there in Edmonton and just the way he plays the game, and it's hard to say, you know, there's a better individual player than him. But I firmly believe that, like, when you play a role in being an elite player and leading your team to a Stanley Cup, like suddenly you're looked at, you know, way different moving forward. And then the fact that, consider how good he was that season, I mean, he's one-upped himself here. Like I love watching him play, just the power and the intensity with that he seems to bring every night. It's just a really entertaining brand to watch. And to a lesser degree, like I think of like when Tampa Bay was going on their cup final runs and winning all the time. Like I love watching Braden Point. I know he's a couple tiers lower, but just like how hard he played, how relentless he was. Like it was so fun to watch him. And Nathan MacKinnon, I would say, he's certainly just a couple notches above in terms of how great he is. You're looking at going, it was, especially when it comes to the best, it's like, you know, well, who's the best comedian of all time? What was the best flavor of ice cream? Like everyone's got kind of their own spin and nuance of why they like one thing over the other. But if the report came out tomorrow that he's been declared the best, you go, well, yeah, I guess you could just say there's Connor McDavid in Edmonton that may have something to say about it, but I wouldn't lose any sleep over that, that's for sure.
Kyle, you've covered the Ottawa Senators very closely across the last decade, so you're familiar with strange hockey stories. Where would the Jager bobblehead robbery rank?
If it was real?
Is it not real?
Well, I don't know. There was a pretty slick video with Jager put together, so I don't know.
Do you think it's – it was slick, but it also looked like something you could have filmed in an emergency in an afternoon.
Yes. Yeah. I wonder – because wasn't there something about the press release about this is only going to add to Jaromir Jagr that maybe have tipped their hand a little bit there? But, like, what a great way to lean into it. Like, considering how and Pittsburgh was just through Ottawa here, and I mean they tied it late, and then the Senators won in overtime on Tuesday night. But talking to some of the people at the organization, man, like I mean this whole downturn and how things have come off the rails, like it's hit a lot of people hard. Can only imagine how the players and the coaching staff feel. But there's a sense of like you knew at some point the glory days were going to ultimately. The well was going to run dry, but it still, you can sense it's hit down like a ton of bricks. So to be able to try to make something fun and positive and a little more lighthearted, given, you know, what's been going on around the organization the last couple of weeks. Good for them for doing so. So, but yeah, like, cause especially, what was the 20,000 bobbleheads?
Something like that. 15,000. Yeah.
What do you do with all those?
How do you move them? I mean, I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah. Like, how do you keep that hidden? That's quite the, that would be quite the job.
What's the street value on those bobbleheads?
Yeah, exactly. Especially that many. It's not like it certainly wouldn't be a rare find if they start getting distributed.
I mean, Yager's played so many
places.
That
was a great one to wake up to.
Yager's played so many places. You'd have plenty of markets, I guess, to try to move them. All right, Kyle, this was fun. Thanks for playing along and putting up with us. Have a great day.
Thanks for your patience, bud.
Oh, my gosh. No, never about putting up with you guys. This is a joy. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, no, our pleasure. Thanks for doing it. That is Kyle Bukauskas from Sportsnet and Hockey Night in Canada having some fun with us here, weighing in on the Canucks and the probably fake. It's certainly looking fake. And I don't say that with any anger.
If
like,
it's
shout
if it's,
out to them.
If it's fake, it's hilarious.
Great bit. Great idea.
But also, if it's real and they had to lean into it, it's hilarious.
That's funny, too. That's a great pivot.
You know what I'm saying?
Yes. But I think it's produced.
Right.
But that's fine. Smart. Good for them. And as Kyle said, like, needing a smile in that organization, man. They are down on their team. I did want to – I thought that was a good question you asked Kyle about who has the best chances to be Canada's team. It's Jets with a bullet, number one with a bullet. And I think the Leafs, number four with a bullet.
You
think people are going to get on board with the Canucks over the Jets? I think you'd
I don't
be
know.
Shocked
no.
at how long the rest of Canada's memories of
no,
the 2011 team
I don't. I think Canucks fans are annoying enough that there will be a certain segment of – Canadian hockey fans. And by the way, I say that with love. Like,
yes.
Annoying in the best way. Like, they don't even know how good we have it. You know?
I mean, I think
people always say, like, oh, you know, enjoy the playoff run. Like, Canucks fans, they're on to the next dramatic thing. And it's like, yeah. People care. It's awesome.
Yeah.
But the rest of Canada thinks that's annoying.
Oh, yeah. No. And again, I think Canucks fans should wear that as a badge of honor.
Absolutely.
Right? Like, it means you're a big deal, right?
Totally.
When you have that much kind of clout with the rest of Canada. I guess what I would say is precondition yourself now not to get worked up about it.
Yeah.
Lean into it. Don't be disappointed when the rest of Canada sees the team as villains.
But it's like how the Leafs will never be able to really be Canada's team. But
no.
Also, if they ever make the Stanley Cup final, there'll be 20 million people watching.
Oh, of course.
You know?
Yeah.
And like how Canadians are far more predisposed to root for the Habs, except anyone who's a Leafs fan. You know what I mean?
Uh-huh.
Like, it's easy for Canadians.
Although
to be like,
I would.
Yeah, you lived in Montreal.
Yeah, so they're down there for me. But
yeah.
Still, I choose them over the Leafs. No doubt.
100%. Now, so your Winnipeg theory, though, like, why doesn't it apply to Ottawa?
It does apply to Ottawa. They're just not going to be in the playoffs.
Does it apply to when they go deep? Do people want Ottawa to win?
I don't know if more people want them to win, but fewer people have a problem with it.
Right.
Right? And I think that's ultimately what it comes down to is it's not – because, as you said, the casual fans will get on board with whoever. So then it's like
– so how do the Flames stack up in it?
The Flames would be probably next after Winnipeg and Ottawa.
See, I think Ottawa, Calgary, and Winnipeg don't have enough sizzle to translate.
But here's what it is, though, is it's that it's – you can,
there's
two ways you can do this. So it's by one is by attracting people, and you're right, they don't have sizzle. The Jets, for a while there, did have sizzle because it's like the Jets came back. It's such a good story, but I think that's worn off.
Yeah.
By this point. But the other way is by not repelling people. And those teams have the least repellent power.
The push-pull factor.
Yeah, you know what I mean?
But see, I think attraction matters more in entertainment. I think ultimately, you know, if Winnipeg makes the Stanley Cup final, people will be like, that doesn't upset me or excite me. And that's not where you want to be.
But that's how you become Canada's team.
That's not how you demand mind share. Like, you have
to. Well, no, but now we're talking about a different thing. Like, they obviously the Leafs would demand the most attention. That doesn't mean they'd be Canada's team.
I agree with you. That's just high decibel level. I'm talking about which team could break through and, like, enter the zeitgeist and have people be, like, pretty excited for it. And I think fundamentally.
I think any Canadian team that goes to a Stanley Cup final, people are paying attention.
Well, yeah, but we saw it with Montreal, and it was kind of meh.
That was the bubble, though.
Yeah.
Or was it the year after?
The year after, but nonetheless.
So it was like
Canada was still locked down.
Yeah, it was
in parts of it.
Yeah, because were there even fans in the building for the final?
Very limited, and it was the first time in this country that it had been like 500.
So
fans.
It was. That's an asterisk, I think. And also, everyone knew that Habs team sucked,
including Habs ownership firing the GM 2 weeks after we're making the it was maybe 2 weeks into the next season. But I think McDavid. See, here's the thing about
McDavid. I think the Oilers are really interesting because people will look at it and say, like, hardcore hockey fans, especially here in Vancouver, will look at it and say they've already won so many cups. I'm tired of McDavid. But I think, like, eventually McDavid is going to pass into, because people forget there were a lot of anti-Sidney Crosby people early in his career, right? And eventually, when you're as good as Connor McDavid is, like, eventually you pass into the Joe Sakic, Steve Yzerman, where you're just like, you're a Canadian legend because you did so well. And there's going to be a lot of people that are happy for a player like that to win a Stanley Cup if he does.
What's funny is Crosby won the Stanley Cup. And that still wasn't enough.
No.
It wasn't until he'd also won gold.
And then two more Stanley Cups.
Yeah. But
in terms of like...
McDavid, though, has loosened up so much this year. Mm-hmm. He's so much funnier, so much more engaging, so much more willing to play the game, that if that team goes deep, McDavid's doing Pavel Bure stuff on the ice and... appearing to be like far more human and likable off of it, you know, as the visibility of these games turns up, you know, like who's the guy who could have like the Matthew Tkachuk style star turn?
Yeah.
Who's the guy who could like really capture the imagination? You know, like I think Connor McDavid elevates the Oilers in a different way. So I see Winnipeg's the safe pick, but I feel like Edmonton's.
I also
the
think
pick.
There's a segment of people in Canada who like hockey but aren't like live and die with their hometown's team, know Connor McDavid, know that he is a generational player, one of the best players in a long time, and those people will be happy to see him win a cup. You know what I mean?
20 minutes on Canada's team with 15 games to play, baby.
But that's a slice of the population that exists.
Yes.
It's not our listeners.
No.
Right? So maybe people might react against it, but like that exists. You know, like your friend's mom who's like watches hockey sometimes and is like, that's nice for Connor McDavid.
The mom test is a key.
Yeah. And they will be happy for Connor McDavid.
100%.
So it could be Edmonton, but I just think Winnipeg is just by default. Like, who's going to cheer against Winnipeg? Who's going to root against Winnipeg? Haven't they suffered enough?
You know, like,
lots of people, the Canada's team people will.
I don't know. And what's the, it, like, is Nate Schmidt and Brendan Dillon are the biggest personalities on the team? Come on.
Don't do Brendan Dillon dirty like that.
No, I said he's
local product.
I was giving him kudos for being one of the biggest personalities on that team.
That's true.
There's no one who can break through from that group.
No, probably not.
Not even close to the scale of a Connor McDavid or, you know, like a number of X guys.
JT Miller.
Yeah, JT Miller, Quinn Hughes. Thatcher Demko. Well, probably not. But the other two.
Nick texts in, my mom hates Connor McDavid. Well, fair enough, Nick. That's your mom's right. That's your mom's right to do that.
That's so cool.
That's a great text.
Yeah, I wish my mom had a like strong enough opinion to be like, I don't like that guy.
I love somebody. Nick's mom was like on Jim Matheson's side when he asked Leon Draisaitl why he's so pissy. He's like, good on him. Good for you, Matheson.
You roasted the wrong guy. Roast Connor next.
Yeah. Mark makes a good point as well. McDavid representing Team Canada at the Olympics will turn the tide nationally.
100%,
which is a really good point. When 100%. That happens. People will find it a lot easier to get on board Connor McDavid.
Do you think, though, if they play on different lines, that there'll be, like, some Canadians who are team like Zadorov and are like, McKinnon!
Yeah.
McKinnon's
McKinnon
the guy who's
really carried
it.
That team. Yeah. Oh, 100% there will. 100% there will.
Do you think Hockey Canada will ever give me the Barzal, McDavid, McKinnon
probably not.
Line that I've been dreaming about?
Maybe.
It makes sense.
It does.
The fastest line in the history of hockey.
Oh, man.
We
got to make Team Canada at some point. I when the an Olympic announcement happened and I wanted to do it with Dim, and you guys were like, no, that's stupid. Now it's all I want to do for the rest of the show.
Once
I start thinking about it, I can't stop thinking about it.
No, we've got a lot of Canucks stuff to
do. We do, of course. That's not actually what's going to happen. I just, It's like my most.
You can't walk away at the warp speed line and just be like, great, we've solved
it. No, it's my most like typical, stereotypical like sports radio listener thing is that I just like, if you're like, let's make Team Canada, I'm like, I'm in. Let's do it. Let's absolutely go. any time of year, no matter how far we are from the Olympics, let's go. All right, we will take a break though. 650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. Again, as Drancer said, lots more to get into from the Canucks game last night. We'll have an update from practice where the Canucks are as well right now.
And where apparently there's some kung fu fighting going on.
Ooh, Connor, very exciting.
Connor Garland and Philip Hronek come to blows during a battle drill, reports Brendan Batchelor. Ian Cole stepped in to separate them. Philip Hronek wants to recreate that Dakota Joshua feud with Garland in practice and then have that juice.
I think that's fantastic.
I think that's a good approach.
We'll get into it all next here on Canucks Talk, Sportsnet 650. Welcome back to Canucks Talk here on Sportsnet 650. Jamie Dodd, Thomas Drance. We are live from the Kintec studio. Kintec, Canada's favorite orthotics provider, powered by thousands of five-star Google reviews. Sore feet, what are you waiting for? Canucks Talk brought to you by Avenue Machinery and Douglas Lake Equipment. Be a champion on the worksite. Find them together online at dleamc.com. 650, 650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. Drancer, you were talking off the top. What a good mood you're in, right? Big games being played by the Canucks. Beautiful weather outside here in Vancouver. We've got the week off next week. It's all very exciting. The Canucks not in such a good mood at practice, it seems. As you mentioned just before the break, our guy Brendan Batchelor reporting Connor Garland and Philip Hronek came to blows during a battle drill. Ian Cole stepped in to separate them. I got to be honest. Now, I know this is Garland's second practice fight of the year, going back to training camp, I believe it was, or preseason anyways, with Dakota Joshua, who eventually became great line mates together. Connor Garland and Philip Hronek, if you had asked me to guess the pair that would fight at practice today, it would have taken me a long time to come up with those two names, especially the Philip Hronek side.
See, I think that makes a ton of sense.
Like, he's just like, and this is not a criticism at all, but he's not a super emotive guy. Which doesn't mean he doesn't have emotions, obviously, but it's just you don't see it necessarily when you're watching the games.
No, but if you're watching the games, you see the mean mugging. You know, like, he's not engaged with the battle. He is not a classic puck mover, right? Like, he's got some ill intent out there on a pretty regular basis. There's a lot of extracurricular stuff around Hronek. He's always in the way, which I mean in a good way, right? Mm-hmm. He's not in Quinn Hughes' way. He's in his opponent's way. You know, and Garland, you see it every couple games. You can tell, like, there's just teams that just go after him. Like, the Bruins always go after him. Probably because he's a Massachusetts guy and they, like, know him from the summer, right? Garland's a guy who gets under people's skin, and Hronek's a guy who takes umbrage. I think this one makes sense.
All right. Yeah, I mean, Garland, as you said, gets under people's skin. Not his first go-around fighting a teammate.
It's part of his value. You know, like,
I don't know about in practice,
Connor,
but in games, it sure is.
Well, it got Dakota Joshua going.
It sure did. It sure did.
Yeah, I don't know that I
lit that spark under Dakota Joshua.
You know, these are things that are not criticisms, right? Philip Hronek's always in the way. That's a good thing. Connor Garland's annoying. Also a good thing.
Great thing in hockey, man. Yeah. Are you kidding? Fantastic thing in the NHL. By the way, I'm a little bit surprised by this. Now, they do have another practice tomorrow before they play Washington on Saturday, so plenty of time for the coaching staff to kind of get in the lab, work some different things up, but no lineup changes, really, with the exception of Tyler Myers drawing back in to the core of regulars on the blue line, paired with Carson Soucy And then Ian Cole and Nikita Zadorov lining up together. So Juulsen drops out again based on this configuration today. We heard Rick Tocchet yesterday say Myers could have played in that game, but they wanted to ease him in. So it looks like he'll have a good opportunity to play, get back in the lineup against Washington on Saturday. But no changes to the forward group. And as I said, a little bit surprising for me. I mean, a lot of people texted in about it. We should talk about it. That was a poor game for Elias Pettersson in his line last night.
Yep.
Now, this is one of those things where you can acknowledge that that was a poor game and a poor effort without immediately jumping to, oh, $11 million is a mistake, yada, yada, yada. Elias Pettersson has been doubted at a lot of different points in his career in Vancouver, and he's always eventually proved those doubters wrong.
The most important and wholly positive transaction in this management group's highly successful last 16 months is a mistake. I mean, I guess I said it about the Hronik trade, but no, I mean, it was a bad game. I don't know what he wasn't good. He's still Elias Pettersson. He's going to be vital to this team.
Now, I think it is fair because the shape of it, like, it was a bad game. Sometimes players have bad games. It's just one-offs, whatever, who cares? You walk away from it. The shape of it and specifically how it went down last night actually does elevate it a little bit from that for me, because we've talked so much about credit for different forwards getting assigned to different forwards, but actually it belongs to Quinn Hughes in a lot of cases, right? Because really, that's who's having success. The forward line that's playing with Quinn Hughes tends to be the line that's having most success in any individual game for the Canucks. Last night, which I thought was fascinating, especially in the first two periods, it was JT Miller and his line, plus the Ian Cole, Carson Soucy pairing, going up against the super unit for Colorado, right? Nathan McKinnon's line and the Cale Makar and Devon Taves pairing. And JT Miller and that group handled things really, really well. But it wasn't true best on best, right? Because it wasn't Quinn Hughes and Filip Hronek out there. You know, they get the two goals in the first period. Even in terms of scoring chances, it was pretty favorable for JT Miller against that five-man unit for Colorado. And when you decide to go for that matchup, as Rick Tocchet, right, you're putting JT Miller out there in a tough spot and you're saving Quinn Hughes for other minutes. Then you get Quinn Hughes and Elias Pettersson out there together an awful lot. You should have the expectation of really, really winning those matchups. So Pettersson and Hughes played about just over 7 minutes of 5-on-5 time in that game. Scoring chances were 8-1 for Colorado. Mm-hmm. And that's a really stunning number. Like, from the moment they started playing together, when Hughes and Pettersson have been on the ice has traditionally been tilted for the Canucks. Going back to the start of their careers together here in Vancouver, that has been the case. That's a stunning number, especially considering it wasn't coming against Nathan McKinnon and Cale Makar. It was coming against Casey Mittelstadt and Sean Walker and Joss Manson. And so I do think it's fair to highlight Elias Pettersson as having a really poor effort in that game. Doesn't mean he's going to be bad for the rest of the season. It doesn't have to mean anything beyond that. But I am curious, when you factor that in with, you know, Elias Lindholm still not making an offensive impact, does there need to be a juggle of the lines? Does there need to be an adjustment to get those players going? Well, that's my question.
I mean, the Elias Lindholm question to me is completely separate, because those struggles are real and very pronounced. You know, like that.
The Lindholm one.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, he was at the net front on the last second goal, and he was the guy who gave the puck away on the game tying goal to sustain that Avs possession. That's tough. Mm-hmm. Those are two tough goals to be,
especially when
you're
supposed to be, like, even if you're not producing, you're the super reliable defensive guy out there, right? That's a really tough situation to be in.
Yeah. Has he been outperformed by Teddy Bluger?
I don't think it's completely out of the question.
Has he been outperformed by Pugh Suter? Yes. The answer is yes.
Mm-hmm.
With a bullet on both questions. So, you know, they need more from him. They need more from Pettersson for sure. Now, that said, and I think it's important not to lose sight of this. Everything about how this team's game is trending at 5-on-5 remains incredibly favorable. Like, what sort of stands out about that effort last night was how distinct that last 20 minutes felt from so much of what we've seen from this team, not even just over their win streak, but, you know, since the All-Star break, where their form has been, you know, a little bit more gravity bound, right? Everything about how this team's playing is trending in the right direction. And when you look at how the team's controlling play, the Pettersson on the ice, like, I see zero cause for concern, right? Big picture, I don't see a ton of cause for concern. The big gap, for example, between his line's performance and the Miller line's performance post All-Star break, and we know that Miller's been, you know, like Godzilla level hot, right? Like nuclear fire breath and lasers out of his eyes. But the gap offensively is not significant. They've both been on the ice for a ton of goals for. They've both played well. The Canucks are controlling play with both players on the ice generally over their last 20 games. And you know, at a level that the top six wasn't at for much of the season when we were spotlighting it as some, you know, a matter of concern. Like right now, Vancouver's top six is actually carrying play ably, and that's with both Miller and with Pettersson on the ice. So yeah, Pettersson had a really bad game last night. You don't love to see it. You want to see him bounce back and bounce back in a significant way when you get to the game against the Washington Capitals. But like the fundamental difference between the Miller and the Pettersson line 5-on-5 anyway, since, you know, over an extended sample of games for this team, the last 20, is effectively that, you know, Pettersson's been on the ice for 14 goals against, Miller for 5, and that doesn't come down really to defensive performance so much as it comes down to a gap in save percentage, 9.49 with Miller on the ice and 8.52 with Pettersson on the ice. Like that's the gap. I don't know that that's under the control of either guy. You just want to see more tactile moments where Pettersson seizes control of the game. Last night would have been a good moment for him to break it open,
especially because it was favorable matchups. Like that's the thing that really stands out to me is the part of getting Miller out there against MacKinnon that worked. Like if you can have those, if you can sick the Miller line and the not Quinn Hughes pairing against opposition as good as that and have that result. I don't even mean the goals, but just in terms of
play them to a draw.
You feel really good. You feel really, really good about what Elias Pettersson and Quinn Hughes should be able to do together. And as you said, just needed to have that moment where he stepped up, even if it was in the third period, just having a heavy shift, not even scoring, but calming the game down in the third period. And, you know, Rick Tocchet spoke after the game. You were there and you know, he had some very similar things to say, I think in a response to one of your questions, right? Like, MacKinnon stepped up, took over the game. We needed to have a couple of guys counteract that and do something similar. Now, again, you have to keep it in focus. You have to keep it in perspective. Peter in Vancouver texts in, I acknowledge EP40's talent, but he has a bad game way too often. Quite simply, he is not a game breaker.
That's
he
not
has
true.
Been a game breaker his entire career.
Yeah.
Has it been often enough this past month? No. But I don't think all of a sudden that Elias Pettersson has lost the ability to break a game open with his talent or that he has lost the ability to consistently drive play at 5-on-5. I mean, it was last week he scored that goal in L.A., right? Like that was a game-breaking goal that ended up being key in that game to get to tie the game and eventually get them the win allow them to win in overtime. So I understand the frustration now, and when you see a performance like that and it kind of leads, it contributes so much to a loss, I completely understand where the frustration is coming from. But he has been a game breaker. He is a game breaker. And I still believe very, very much so in the final 15 games here of the regular season, however long they last in the playoffs, you are going to see game breaking moments from Elias Pettersson. That's what he does. That's what he's always done in the NHL.
It's just so there's a lot of random distribution going on here. Like here's the fact. Pettersson's on-ice numbers still look good. Canucks have scored 16 goals with him on the ice 5-on-5 since the All-Star break across 18 games. That's very good. And that's despite a shooting percentage that's at about 10%. He's not... like, he's one of the very few guys where you see a shooting percentage of 10%, you're like, he should probably... He can probably sustain a conversion rate double that. Right? He still has 10 points. Still has 10 points, 5-on-5 in 18 games. You know, for context, Miller's got 12 leading the team, right? Like, I don't know. I don't know the overall, like, I don't know where the overall he's not breaking games is coming from. I think it's just that Miller's run so hot and that there feels like there's a contrast.
It's that Miller, and to be fair, Miller has had the plays that scream at you in the face.
Yeah.
Right? And
he always does.
He always does, but Pettersson does usually in his career as well, right?
Sure.
So I think it's the spike in Miller and then the relative lack from Pettersson that is causing the contrast.
But see, I think you're seeing them. I still think you're seeing those plays from Pettersson. They're just like that goal against LA was huge.
For sure. Like that, I totally agree.
He had one of the most dominant shifts that this team's had in the last month, where it was the 3-1 goal against Minnesota, right? And it's just a picture perfect shot. His goal against the Jets was key in pacing that victory, right? Making it really lopsided and making sure there was no drama late. It just feels selective to me. Like it really just doesn't hold up under closer scrutiny, Jamie. Like the more I look at it, the more convinced I am that it doesn't actually make a ton of sense. He's been on the ice for more goals than any other Canucks forward. You know, there's some ugly save percentage stuff going on. There's some unsustainably low personal shooting percentage stuff going on, but that's about it. Like, this is still a player playing at a extraordinarily high level. And, you know, at the end of the day, they're not going to win a playoff series if he doesn't step on the ice and is the best forward in that series, right? Like, so I get why people are concerned, but I just don't see any actual, like, quantifiably, I don't really see why this has become such a copious talking point, except for the contrast with Miller and the pressure that comes naturally after you sign a big extension.
Yeah, those are the two things. And again, I think it's just like
I don't think either of those are fair, though.
The lack of plays that kind of anchor in your mind. You know what I mean? And I think part of this, and I wanted to talk about this as well, I think part of it is the power play, right? Like, how different would the conversation around Elias Pettersson be if not only did he have, you know, a few extra points on the power play in that span, but he'd wired home a one-timer or something like that, right? Or sent an incredible cross-ice pass to JT Miller at the front of the net for a power play goal, right? Like, that's a chance. The power play is an opportunity to create those types of moments that can really affect what you're thinking about a player. And the power play hasn't been good. There was that moment in the third period, 3-3, and they get a power play. That's a crucial opportunity. And again, just yesterday, Rick Tocchet is speaking about how, you know, power play percentage kind of overrated. What you really need are the success in those key moments. That was one of those key moments late in the game, and it just looked punchless. It looked ineffective, right? Didn't generate those chances. I'm not saying that's Pettersson's fault. I'm just saying if the power play was having more success, I think there's a different conversation around it.
I guess where the distinction comes in for me is there's, like, perception and the descriptive nature of that, right? It's felt a little quiet around Elias Pettersson. I think if you're saying something like that, that's totally fair, right? But I think if you're taking it that next step forward, that next step where it's like Pettersson hasn't been Vancouver's best forward over the last 18 games and as a result is not, right? Like, we've seen it. This guy's this team's best forward. Why did they pay him more than him? What are they doing? Blah, blah, blah. Which is the tone of a lot of the texts we get in. I see zero evidence for that, aside from the fact that, you know, one guy is converting on 2.5 times more of their shots and has a far higher save percentage over a narrow band of time and on ice save percentage. And ultimately, what's interesting about this team right now, what's trending in such a favorable direction for this team right now is that both guys are actually going from a controlling play standpoint, which gives this team a way higher ceiling 15 games out from the playoffs, you know? So, yeah, you'd like to see Pettersson have sort of that exclamation mark moment. But if he keeps playing like this, that's coming. You're going to get a run of games where he finishes 20% of his chances.
And I,
like,
think
no
that,
question.
That game last night was kind of a streak breaker in a little bit for him, because I thought he was playing better before that after having signed the contract, right? You go back to that game in LA, as you mentioned, the game against Winnipeg.
Yeah,
like, I think
four
his play,
points in his last five games.
Exactly. Like, his play was demonstrably ticking up. That's why it felt like pretty disappointing and like an outlier last night. And, I'll, you know, as you're saying, like, it's one thing to say he hasn't had those moments. He really struggled last night. He absolutely did.
I even thought he had moments last night. Like, he threw a big hit on McKinnon and separated from him from the puck and earned the clear in the first period. Like, that was a play that had me go like, oh, you know, to some extent, it just felt like the team wasn't moving as a group. But even within that, I didn't notice, like, big mistakes from him. He wasn't poor defensively. He's been winning 55% of his draws since the All-Star break. Like, I don't know, man. I
have no problem looking at his game and wishing for more, right? And I
think that's fine.
Rick Tocchet was wishing for more last night. But where I have trouble with it is when you're looking ahead to the playoffs and thinking it's going to be a problem in the playoffs, right? And again, like, we've been here with Elias Pettersson before, where people are throwing a lot of doubt and asking a lot of questions, and he has responded in a huge, huge way. And it's just, there's nothing in his career up to this point that leads me to believe he won't do something similar at some point this season or at some point into the playoffs. So yeah, was last night frustrating? Would you like to see more? Would you like to see more of those kind of defining superstar moments from Elias Pettersson? You absolutely would. Is he going to be a problem for this team? Is it something that they should be concerned about going into the playoffs? No. I still think he's Elias Pettersson. He's going to be that superstar at some point for them this year. In terms of things that should be a concern, I mean, we talked about the composure. I think the special teams in general as well, right? Now, I know
that's been a big problem.
Two of the penalty kill goals, or the two power play goals, right? One's a 5-on-3, one's a 4-on-3 in overtime. So it's a little bit different.
But also, all of their power play goals, at least the big ones, you know, the Pettersson one aside, have been 4-on-3, 5-on-3.
So, I mean, but you lose the special teams battle 2-0 last night, right?
Yep.
So 5-on-5, you're 3-2. The special teams battle costs you that game. And we've talked a lot about the way they're controlling play, and especially defensively, but we've always used the caveat 5-on-5. It would be really, really unfortunate if this team finds that kind of 5-on-5 level that we've been hoping to see from them and sustains it, especially defensively, but their special teams was what ultimately lets them down. And I'd say that's maybe my, beyond the composure, if we're talking like pure on-ice nitty-gritty stuff, the special teams is a big concern going into the playoffs right
now. Oh, yeah. They've been shooting themselves in the foot with a Gatling gun.
Yep.
Every time the whistle blows, right? And the fact that the whistle hasn't blown in their favor, the reason that's amplified too is that this team struggled to kill penalties and they haven't been able to take advantage of power play opportunities. I mean, they had a big one. I actually thought about Tockett's commentary, the big power play goal.
Yeah.
They had that power play.
Halfway through the third period last night, right? And it's like, if you generate something there, it could be a completely different game. And it was nothing. It was a nothing opportunity. That's a problem. Like, you need to have at least one of those units that you feel good about, that you feel really good about, right?
Yeah.
Going in, and not right now, neither one is that.
Trending rapidly in the wrong direction, right? Just is what it is.
All right, 650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. Lots of people getting their thoughts in about Elias Pettersson. We'll see if we get any more information from practice, maybe from Connor Garland or Philip Hronek about the little scuffle there at practice. See if we get some Rick Tocchet audio as well. Keep sending your texts in. 650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. Final segment of the show coming up here on Canucks Talk. Sportsnet 650. Welcome back to Canucks Talk here on Sportsnet 650. Jamie Dodd, Thomas Drance, live from the Kintech studio here. Final segment of the day. 650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. Dunbar Lumber with three stores to serve you in Ladner on Bridge Street, or Dunbar Lumber Express at Ladner Center, or Arbutus in Vancouver, online at dunbarlumber.com. It's time for the Abbey Farm Report here on Canucks Talk. The Abbey Farm Report is a presentation of David L. Young, Dexter Realty. Abbey Canucks were on home ice in action last night as well. Went better for them than it did for the big club. They win 4-1 over the Bakersfield Condors. Tristan Nielsen got a goal. They actually gave up, the Abbey Canucks gave up a goal just a minute and 10 seconds into the game, but they came back after that. Tristan Nielsen scored. Max Sasson had a goal and an assist, really continuing his strong play in his first full professional season in Abbotsford. Sheldon Dries had a pair of goals as well. Sheldon Dries, remember him? Up to 23 goals on the season down for Abbotsford. And Nikita Tolopiolo, of course, the no-doubt-about-it starter in Abbey, with Archer Seelovs up playing for, or at least with, the Vancouver Canucks right now. Tolopio stops 26 of 27 in the win. First star of the night for the big netminder. Two more games at home for the Abbey Canucks this weekend, Saturday and Sunday, both against Vegas's affiliate, the Henderson Silver Knights. Then they're back out on the road after that. So 7 o'clock game Saturday, Sunday afternoon affair, 4 o'clock on Sunday. So great one to bring the family to there Sunday in Abbotsford against the Henderson Silver Knights. And Abbey's still in that dogfight in the Pacific Division in the AHL for playoff positioning. That was actually a big win last night against Bakersfield. They're trying to jump over Bakersfield for fifth place in the Pacific, which I believe would earn them some home ice advantage in round one of the playoffs. So two more big games coming up this weekend for the Abbey Canucks. You can go get your tickets now.
And a DPD, Elias Patterson, has been assigned to the Abbotsford Canucks, so at some point,
that's right,
Canucks fans will have an opportunity to go watch the club's number two defensive prospect.
That's very exciting as well. The Abbey Farm Report brought to you by David L. Young of Dexter Realty. Here, there, everywhere, visit homes by DavidLYoung.com. Just keeping track of some of the quotes and tidbits. I don't know if we'll have time to get any Rick Tocchet audio in here before the end of the show with the later practice start, but Brendan Batchelor tweeting, Elias Patterson was critical of his personal game last night. When asked what was missing from his play, he replied, I'll keep that to myself. So playing it close to the vest, Elias Patterson, after a tough effort from him last night. Now, we'll keep an eye out for anything else interesting that comes out from Canucks practice at Rogers Arena today. I did want to pass this along. We kind of skipped over the broadsheet portion of the whiteboard today, but I wanted to pass along that our pal Rick Dhaliwal on Donnie and Dolly reporting some information about a couple of pending UFAs on the Canucks blue line. One with Nikita Zadorov, no contract talks yet. And, you know, Dhaliwal not saying that it's not going to happen or there isn't any path towards Zadorov remaining with the team, but also noting that agent Dan Milstein, who, of course, we know well in this market, very, very confident that Nikita Zadorov is going to have a robust market on July 1st if the Canucks do not choose to sign him. And that should come as no surprise. I think we've seen some of the warts at times, too, but I think you've also seen why teams would be very enamored with Nikita Zadorov. I mean, just last night, right? You see what he's doing. But, like, I was saying it on the broadcast last night with Bick, to have a guy who can rush the puck like that on your third pair, we've talked about it too, like adding that extra push of puck moving ability at the bottom of your lineup can be so important. Now, I'm not saying, and therefore they have to re-sign Nikita Zadorov, because I think it's going to take a lot of term and a lot of money to do so. But I also understand why Dan Milstein wouldn't be worried at all about getting that bag for his client in the summer.
Zadorov's going to have a market. He's extremely unique. And I'll be honest with you, I think he's a player you should try and keep if you can. And, you know, a team's plans and what they actually are able to get done change quickly come the offseason, right? I mean, you might want to sign Dakota Joshua, but he scores a big playoff overtime goal from a dirty area of the ice. You know, you may have to turn your attention to someone else. That someone else may end up being Sam Lafferty, right? I mean, things can change. We saw it with Horvat and JT Miller just a few summers ago, right? A team's plans and what they actually are able to accomplish, you know, those are very distinct concepts, and that's important to remember here. Zadorov's really good, and he was excellent last night.
Yeah, he was.
Even late, like, he made two. The Avs were pressing in that last minute. They were all over the Canucks, and he made two scoring chance eliminating defensive plays in the very final minute, and then changes, and obviously we know how that last shift went with Carson Soucy putting the puck over the glass. you know, it'll be fascinating to see exactly how the Canucks get this done. And then Teddy Bluger is going to be an interesting one, too. You know, he was kind of bottom of the market among this specific class of NHL centermen. I mean, go look at the David Kampf deal,
mm-hmm.
the Nick Bjugstad deal, the Lars Eller deal.
Even Pew Suter got 2 years, right? And that was late in the summer. But Pew Suter got 2 years. Teddy Bluger only got one. Now, wow. Lesser AAV for Pew Suter.
And way less production. I mean, Pew Suter should have been like a $4 million player. But anyway, yes, even Pew Suter got 2 years. So Bluger was probably, because he was a healthy scratch on a historically deep team, you know, he was hard done by in free agency last year. And you can understand if he ends up wanting to rectify that, although clearly the fit in Vancouver has been
really good.
So, I mean, interesting stuff from you. And you mentioned that Elliot Friedman noted in 32 Thoughts today. Did you?
No, I didn't actually.
Sorry. He noted that Myers, Dakota, Joshua, Bluger are his expected team priorities. So Rick's commentary, I think, pivots off of that.
Yeah. Now, Rick also noted that Ian Cole, who's also a pending UFA, from his side, would love to stay in Vancouver. Ian Cole, another interesting player, you know, obviously veteran with a ton of experience. I think anytime we've had the chance to hear Ian Cole give his thoughts on the team, we've been really, really impressed.
Yep.
You can sense the wisdom and the experience there. I also think his play has slipped a little bit from where it was early in the year. Not that he's been bad necessarily, but I was really, really impressed early in the year. I think you've seen a little bit more of the, you know, some of the downside to his game at different points in the year. The blue line in general is going to be so fascinating because we're talking about the UFAs, right? Zadorov, Myers, Ian Cole. I think you can make case bringing back any of them individually, right? But you're probably not going to be able to do them. But the other thing, of course, and we talked about it a lot yesterday on the show, is Phil Pronik. And I wonder if a guy like Zadorov in particular, if you aren't able to reach an agreement with Philip Pronik, if he does end up going elsewhere, does that free up budget on your blue line for you to turn around and, okay, you know what? We didn't think we were going to be able to do that kind of term and money for Nikita Zadorov, but maybe as you change, all of that becomes like your own equipment, but just does it free up the money to spend in other places potentially?
Well, and for example, you know, I think what we're... So let's consider, for example, Myers being on Friedman's list and Zadorov not being on Friedman's list. Is that a pure reflection of the club's assessment, or does it also reflect the cap realities?
100% it does.
Right.
Because Zadorov's going to be way more expensive and way longer commitment than Tyler Myers. Way longer commitment, at least.
Certainly, he's going to be able to demand more term,
yep.
And I think he'd be viewed as a slightly more unique, although the right-handed thing complicates it a little bit. But Zadorov's physical, like his martial skills, his willingness to duke it out. What?
His martial skills.
That's a real thing.
You've been watching Shogun?
I have. So good. Have you been watching it?
I have not, actually.
Oh, man. You should absolutely get on that. Sorry, my eyes lit up. I got so excited. Anyway, his martial skills. His heavyweight...
He's been in the
bona
dojo.
Fides. Yeah. His heavyweight bona fides make him pretty unique and marketable. But, you know, again, in terms of things can change. Best laid plans,
no,
right?
If you were talking just about... Of those three, if you were just talking about impact, who you want next year in terms of impact on the ice, Zadorov would be number one. But you can't just do it like that. You have to factor in the cap realities and what the deals are going to look like. And from that perspective, he might be the least likely of the three to re-sign, right? Because his market is going to be so significant. Cannon North Van says, maybe with Zadorov, we can do something longer term with less AAV, say 5+ years. With a lower annual average value. I mean, I think Zadorov's going to be looking for term. We heard that even as soon as he was acquired by the Canucks, right? That was going to be a priority on his next contract. I think there will be teams willing to do that. Yes, he's 28, but still, as you said, for that kind of unique physical package that he brings, I think teams are going to be willing to go long-term. So I don't know how much of an advantage that would give the Canucks if they were willing to do that.
Well, you also may end up in a situation where, you know, and this is kind of what happened with Horvat, right? Part of your assessment is we think we can get a better deal here, right? And then you actually get down to brass tacks and you can't, right? The player's like, no, that's too steep a cut. You know, I'll test my luck. And then who knows, right? I mean, there could be a real market for Tyler Myers. Don't rule that out. I'm In fact,
there will be.
Rule that very much in.
Yeah, there will 100% be a market for Tyler Myers. It is funny because
At some point, like, you know, you have to make a decision as a pro athlete who, you know, Myers is 34. He's made a lot of money. But, you know, probably the last significant contract of his career, because he's going to be a 35-plus contract after this season. Mm-hmm. Right? And any contract, not after this season, after the next year. So his next deal is going to come with even more structurally fraught risk than this one. And if you're looking at three times, you know, four, and contrasting it with two times three, well, that's a massive gap, like literally double, right? It's only a $1 million dollar difference in AAV, but it's a difference of, you know, it's double the total value of the deal. If that's the sort of calculation you're looking at, I mean, that's a really difficult decision to make with your representatives and your family. The Kirk Cousins thing.
Yeah, 100%. This text comes in from Ryan in Penticton. Zadorov really starting to play well after the trade. If I'm ranking current team UFA defense, I'd like to be Sack. I'd put Zadorov, Myers, Cole. There is very little offensive pop on the Canucks blue line aside from 43 and 17. And Zadorov at least has a history of production from the back end. That's from Ryan and Penticton. I think that's a great take by Ryan, right? How often did we, prior to this year, talk about the lack of offensive contributions, and not just like in terms of goals and points, but in terms of contributing in the offensive zone, helping facilitate offense from the Canucks blue line? It has been a huge issue for this team in the past, and not that Zadorov's elite at it or anything, but it's just he's a third pairing guy who can give you legitimate offensive contributions, who can actually help you pressure the other team offensively, and that has a ton of value. And it's value in a way that, you know, I really like Ian Cole, but he doesn't bring that same element.
We're going to need a new rule. So one of our listeners, Abu Omar, who's an awesome follow on Twitter, and I'm sorry to do this to you, Abu, because you're the man. But he says you can't give Zadorov more than Susie. Right? This idea of an internal cap.
Yep.
We're going to hear it a lot with Hronik vis-a-vis Hughes. We're going to hear it a lot with any number of players. Can't give X guy more than Pew Suter. I don't know if we're gonna get
imagine if going into UFA negotiations. No. Pew Suter sets our internal cap for great role players. You're not making more than Pew's
1.6. New rule. We got to retire that. We haven't had cap growth in 6 years.
You don't have to. It's not that it has that. It's not a concept. It's just it only applies in certain situations, and sometimes other factors just completely override that factor, right? And especially, like, I don't really know that I've heard it at the top of the roster, you know what I mean? Where, like, in Boston, hey, so-and-so can't make more or
then
whatever.
Bergeron. And
although
then
Pastrnak did.
And so did McAvoy.
Yeah.
All rules are flexible.
But in the middle of the roster, I really don't think it applies. You know what I mean?
It does. It does apply in that, like, you know, it was definitely a factor in, like, the Pearson extension, where it's like, how can I get 500K less than Beagle and Roussel, right? So it applies both ways. It applies both ways.
That's different, though.
But we're just about to enter such a different world. You know, like, we are, the overall way that the cap is about to grow is just going to warp what we consider. Like, this is, you know, what, 9% cap growth we're looking at? 9.3%? Add a 9.3% surcharge onto literally every deal. Every agent is going to be talking to teams this summer and talking about percentage of the cap, not total AAV. You answer back with total AAV, they'll be like, yeah, but that's a lower percentage of the cap. And is that going to work for everybody? Is that just going to be like, Patrick Alvin's just going to be like on the phone and say, oh, total percentage, my bad. No, obviously it's a push and pull. But that's what everyone's going to be looking for. If you get too stuck, right, adhering to an internal cap set by contracts that are literally 4 months away from being out of date, which is partly why it's such a good thing that the Canucks got Pettersson done when they did, and that Hughes has this number of years left, right? Those contracts are going to be out of date potentially by mid-July and certainly in 14 months, right? You only have a short window where this math even makes sense. you can't, I don't think, be too rigid about internal cap structure in accommodating the reality of like multiple escalator years that are going to predate the expiry of this NHL CBA after the 2025-26 season.
I think it also just comes down to the leverage the player has, right?
Yeah.
And again, this is similar to the why it didn't play a role in the Miller-Pettersson situation, right? Or the Pettersson negotiations and JT Miller's, because that was just not in the ballpark. There was never a situation where Miller's deal was going to anchor Elias Pettersson, giving the leverage that he had. And Nikita Zadorov obviously doesn't have quite that type of leverage, but he's going to be an in-demand UFA on the market, on the blue line, with unique physical tools. The Canucks got Carson Soucy, so got a really, really good deal, right? That doesn't mean that Nikita Zadorov has to take a similar haircut like that, because he can always say, like, look, I could make way more than that on the open market. So if you're grinding me like that, I can just go somewhere else. Now, can you grind a little bit off of it in certain situations because of internal salary cap things? Yeah, you probably can. And there's no reason you shouldn't try to use it as a tool, but you got to recognize where it applies, where it's reasonable, and where the player just doesn't need to think about it. And I think this is a situation where, hey, it's great that you got Carson Soucy on that deal. That's fantastic. But maybe just be happy with that rather than trying to, you know, spin that into keeping everyone else's salary cap down. Cause I don't think it's going to work. Like, I think Zadorov is just, his number is going to be above that.
It'll depend on the market. And you know, Zadorov, you're right. I don't know that that works for him, but I think it's going to be interesting to see how it looks for Bluger, right? It's going to be interesting to see how it looks for Myers. And it's absolutely going to be fascinating to see how it looks for Joshua. You know,
the internal cap thing, or just the market in general for Joshua?
The market in general, market. And how that shapes, you know, the resolution. Now, one thing to watch too, at this time of year last year, the Canucks started going about getting like Brisebois, mm-hmm. Phil DiGiuseppe. Like, there were a ton of deals that the club got done with just about anyone they wanted to keep down the stretch of last season, right? Like, we saw a lot of work to flesh out the bottom end, I suppose you'd call it.
Was Noah Juulsen in that?
Noah Juulsen was in that group, you know, and then obviously we saw more as the summer went on. But this club did a lot of work to lock up, you know, depth players, you know, from within the organization, not to mention the college free agent class, right? Like, we saw a lot of announcements, a steady drumbeat of just like small contractual agreements, two-way deals. I will be fascinated to see, now that Pettersson's resolved, the club's on the other side of the deadline, do we see this team try to get some of these deals done, or do they need to figure out Hronek first?
The signs we're getting, and even just the reporting from Rick Dhaliwal today, which is not the first time he's reported, you know, zero talks between the Canucks and different UFAs, like, the signs are pointing to the latter, that they feel like they need to get Hronek done. And I even wonder if it's more than that, to be honest, if they just want to keep their options really, really open this summer.
Well,
like,
they do.
Hronek or not. You know what I mean?
They do, because the cap space thing, right, the amount of expiring money the Canucks have, it's going to, I don't want to minimize the challenge ahead and that it is going to be difficult to run in place, even much less improve, given some of the structural factors looming over this team, the Hronek raise, the mm-hmm. Pettersson raise, the OEL buyout expansion, the age of players like JT Miller. I mean, there's some challenges that this club's going to have to address intelligently, the way they addressed a variety of challenges this past summer. They're going to have that level of success again, fleshing out the depth of this roster, just to have this kind of dream season or sustain this level, because they've also set an enormously high bar for themselves. But there's also opportunity.
There's a ton of flexibility. Yeah. And I think part of it is, I wonder how much they're keeping their options open, because they're going to learn a lot about this team and the market is going to learn a lot about this team going into the playoffs.
Yep.
Right? Because all of a sudden, the valuation on your UFAs, which could complicate things for you, right? Like, we've talked about the, you know, if Dakota Joshua has a big series, what that could do for his value. I mean, Nikita Zadorov with the brand of his hockey that he plays, same thing. But it helps you on the trade market potentially as well. Like, there's that side of it. And I just wonder if how much of it is, we're going to get a sense of who we think could help us win in these playoffs. We want to gather that information, see what the team looks like in the playoffs, and we'll have a much better sense of what these guys are going to cost, who we can move, what are all the things we can do, whatever the things we want to do, who do we want to keep around once we get this extra bit of information. And I think that just becomes so much, it becomes so much easier to have that stance once you have Elias Pettersson, right? Because now you know, worst case scenario, you've got Pettersson, Miller, Hughes, Demko signed for the next 2 years and beyond, in every case other than Demko, at a number you're comfortable with. Once you have that, not that you want to be turning over the other, you know, 20 spots on your roster or whatever, 18 spots on your roster every year. But once you have that, I think it becomes so much easier to be a little bit more patient, right? Mm. You see what we want to do. Because if you're building around that, you feel pretty, you're starting from a good spot at least. So even if you do have to make some big changes, even if you do have to say goodbye to a bunch of UFAs, I think it gives you so much more confidence to be flexible, to see where things take you, rather than, uh-oh, we've got so many UFAs. We got to wrap these. We got to sign these guys up. We can't lose these guys. I think they're in a position where they can be a lot more patient and a lot more confident going into the summer now.
Yeah, it's they're really well positioned, ultimately. It's taken a lot of work to get them here.
You know what they're well positioned for more than anything is entertainment.
Yeah, they are.
I think it could be a fascinating offseason. And so much depending on what happens in the playoffs.
They could take a big swing, right? And they probably have some of the players. You know, like, one thing that's interesting to me is I don't get a sense of urgency about a Besser extension.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, I think that one's not going to be one that we're necessarily talking about regularly on July 1st, even though it becomes a reality beginning July 1st. You know, that we know that this club's had an up-and-down assessment of Myers, for example. How does that play out? Garland,
mm-hmm.
you know, has repeatedly been on the trade block. Has he rebuilt enough value that he's a positive asset? Like, what are you looking at there? And how does the club decide, you know, to react to whatever happens in the playoffs? Right? That, I mean, end of the day, they're in so much better a place than we imagined would be 12 months ago. But, you know, there was a lot that had to go right this season for the Canucks to get here. We know that. There's a lot that's going to have to keep going right for this team for them to improve from here.
I think the way I look at it is there's a lot of uncertainty this summer, which carries risk, but also opportunity, but also upside, because it gives you the chance to do some different things.
And we'll cover it all on the other side
You know who's scintillating playoff race. So excited about that is Jim Rutherford. Jim Rutherford with opportunities and flexibility. Let's go. Let's go. I am here for it.
I'm going to set the market twice.
I'm going to do it again. Let's make some moves. I can't wait. But yeah, we got a lot of hockey to play before we get there, including hopefully a good playoff run from the Canucks come April. One more show of the week tomorrow. That'll wrap it up for us. And then, we're on vacation next week. We'll leave you in the capable hands of Brooke Ward in this time slot. Always a pleasure to have Brooke on the station. So we're back tomorrow, then off next week. Have a great day. You've got it right here on Sportsnet 650.